Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 4th of March. It's all things political for this hour. We have a lot to talk about. The Supreme Court is taking up voting rights and specifically weighing Shelby County's challenge to a portion of the law that requires states with a history of racial discrimination, mostly in the Deep South, to get approval from the Justice Department before implementing any changes in election laws. Yesterday, there was a commemoration and a reenactment of the march to from Selma to Montgomery, and the vice president and black leaders took this march and had quite a bit of discussion about the Voting Rights Act. We will talk about the Supreme Court's imminent decision this hour of the program. Of course, the sequester is another issue. We've been talking about it for some time now, but are we seeing effects of the sequester? Immigration reform, will we move on to other issues, latest foreign policy matters with the new Secretary of State, and many other issues this hour, the continuing philosophical divide. Our guest is Professor James McCormick. He is professor and chair in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. We'll be weighing in on your calls and thoughts on the issues of the day as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, if you'd like to leave messages there, we'd love to hear from you, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor James McCormick, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
When is the Supreme Court weighing in on this voting rights issue? Is it this week or a little bit later?
No, they had hearings last week on this, and I don't expect a decision until sort of towards the end of the session. Usually there are a whole tumbling down of decisions in sort of the June period of the year. So I think it'll be some time before we get a disposition on this case.
What did you make of the hearings? Does it look like it's going one way or another?
Well, if you look at the reporting of the comments of the justices, you know, it looks like that there might well be a decision to overturn Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which requires this so-called preclearance. That is, if one of the identified states in this case, or really districts as well, tries to change the voting procedures within their jurisdiction, they would have to get a preclearance from the Justice Department. And if that were overturned by the Supreme Court, of course, they would not have to do that. Why that's germane? It's germane in a couple ways. As you know, there's been a lot of movement in states for early voting here. There's been movements for, you know, using write-ins or paper ballots and that sort of thing ahead of the date of the election. So these kind of changes, if in this case Shelby County, Alabama, which is the litigant here, if they wanted to make any changes in that direction, they would have to get approval from the Justice Department. So, you know, it would have some impact in that sense. My guess is that it's going to be a very narrow decision. And again, in a lot of these Supreme Court cases, and Justice Kennedy is kind of the swing justice here. I mean, if you look at the comments that were made, Justice Scalia was really very concerned about whether this section and frankly the Voting Rights Act had outlived its usefulness here. On the other side, Sonia Sotomayor really questioned whether we still have to be concerned about racial discrimination in the voting booth here.
Mm-hmm. It was by no means accidental that the Vice President of the United States, the first sitting Vice President, participated in the annual reenactment yesterday.
No, it was not, and obviously it's very significant. And his call out to the courts to reject Shelby County, Alabama's litigation here is sort of indicative of how the executive branch sees this issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the economy for a moment. The New York Times had an interesting front page story today, and it goes like this: with the Dow Jones Industrial Average flirting with a nominal record high, the split between American workers and the companies that employ them is widening and could worsen in the next few months as federal budget cuts take hold. What would put pressure on companies to raise salaries, to maybe broaden the workforce here? Why is there such a divide between how the Dow Jones is doing and how workers are doing?
Well, I think what has happened is, you know, that lots of companies, and I might even say lots of educational institutions, have gone to increase the demands and efficiency from their employees. They are really trying to wring out any kind of inefficiency or wring out any kind of problem that they might have internally or any laxness. And I think this is what you're really seeing. And these companies obviously are profiteering from this considerably. I don't say that necessarily in a negative way, but there's certainly profits have continued to go up, and the Dow Jones continues to, you know, reach near record high here. What would make them hire more workers? I think a couple things that would really help here, and you know, it does relate to Washington and this larger kind of economic question. I suspect that many companies would like to expand, but there's a certain degree, or maybe a lots of degree, of uncertainty about what the future holds in terms of whether it's tax policy or spending policy here, and that's holding back this expansion. And once they do that, I think, you know, then they not only hire more people, but there's also, I think, an impetus to have some increases in salaries for workers.
I'm wondering if we're seeing any impact now because of the sequester. There are some politicians who are saying they will be minimal. There are others who are saying a lot of federal workers are going to be furloughed. People are going to be in more dire financial straits. Is there an immediate impact? Will there be a more long-term impact?
I think the immediate impact will be, you know, in certain areas of the country. You know, you can think of sort of East and West Coast here. I think San Diego might be hit because of the military cuts and their heavy reliance upon the Navy here. You know, see some cutbacks there. The other area, of course, would be Northern Virginia. So In some ways, the coasts would maybe have more of an immediate impact. At least I would see it. You know, there's been talk about, you know, in sort of the Midwest and particularly in Iowa, you know, what would be the impact on agricultural inspections and that sort of thing. But I think Secretary Vilsack, Secretary of Agriculture Vilsack, the other day said, you know, that maybe this would not be as quite as severe, you know, as maybe some other areas of the country. So I think it really will be differential in the country. I mean, the immediate impact will be much more differential. There is going to be obviously a slowdown in some responses. You know, they talk about TSA workers, you know, at airports and that sort of thing. But there's always been long lines at many airports, so I'm not sure that this is going to be too much of a surprise here. And frankly, I don't know about Wisconsin Public Radio, but certainly educational institutions, we have had these kind of cutbacks and have had to deal with kind of these squeezes. So I'm not trivializing the impact of furloughs, but I think these are something that probably can be managed more effectively than some of the public relations efforts on this.
John Boehner, if he said it once, he said it 100 times yesterday and over the past few days. The president got his tax hikes in January. That's it.
Well, I think there's a glimmer of change. I noticed on one of the interview programs yesterday morning that a couple of the Republican senators talked about that they were ready, and I think even with the House action now talking about, you know, extending, even though it's going to be the sequester, but giving the president more flexibility through the end of the fiscal year, which would be, you know, the end of September here, and then trying to move towards a larger kind of budgeting mechanism here. Lindsey Graham, for example, the senator from South Carolina, I was somewhat surprised to see was sort of laying out that, you know, that they would get more tax revenues could come in, but they would only be in the context of also touching sort of entitlements and doing something about and really moving in the direction of this kind of larger package. And so it would not be so much raising taxes as sort of changing the tax code to increase revenue. But obviously that would be increases in taxes for some. But also that would be juxtaposed with this larger kind of agreement on doing something on entitlements. I mean, that's always been sort of the holy grail, it seems to me, in terms of trying to get a handle on the budget is that, you know, it's been an either or kind of proposition, making spending cuts or making tax increases. But really, there's a third thing, you know, leaving out entitlements. And frankly, you know, I'm at the age where entitlements mean something to me at this moment. But I think there's something has to be done about it in terms of having a $16.7 trillion debt. It just doesn't make any sense.
So this will be the year for major discussion and major action on Medicare and Social Security?
Well, we'll see. I'm hopeful that that would be the case. I was encouraged by the comments of both sort of sides here, saying that they're, first of all, not going to have another, it looks like we're not going to have another budget showdown on March 27th, that the House is going to sort of, and I guess sotto voce, the White House has agreed that they'll continue the sequester cuts and extend, funding of the government through the end of the fiscal year. Now, I think there's some of the write-up on this and even the comments that were yesterday saying that this has made this gigantic dent. There's a big if on that, and that is if these cuts are really extended from year to year, and we know that Congress doesn't always extend even what they say from one year to the next. But at least in the short term, it looks like they're going to extend it, and that really sets the sort of the plate, if you will, for having these larger kind of discussions here.
Oh, they'd be in big trouble if they shut down the government at the end of March, wouldn't they? Everybody would say that's enough.
They really would, and I don't, you know, it's hard to pick out winners and losers. I think going into this sequester debate, it seems to me that the president had the high ground. You know, public opinion was on his side, and Republicans were getting more blame. But I think really the administration made a mistake and, trotting out day after day, including the president himself, saying how disastrous these cuts were going to be. And it became a parody for some. You know, that how if we met March 1st and the sequester went into effect, we'd fall off the end of the earth here. And, that just really wasn't a reality here. Certainly some sectors are going to be hurt. I don't want to minimize that. And the military is taken, in some ways the bulk of these kind of cuts, at least in the short term, although if we can believe what the administration and the House is saying, they're going to give the president more flexibility and, presumably, if that piece of legislation extending the sequester through the end of the fiscal year and giving the president the prerogative to instruct agencies for more flexibility in their cuts, and particularly the military, maybe this can be managed in a more sensible sort of way.
Well, welcome phone calls. We have several coming in right now. There is room for you at this very moment. We're talking all things political this hour of the program, starting off with the reenactment of the 1965 Selma to Montgomery Voting Rights March, which took place yesterday. Of course, we're still talking about the sequester and the philosophical divide. We have yet to move into foreign policy, which we will do in just a moment. Here's our phone number for you to talk with Professor James McCormick, Professor and Chair, Department of Political Science at Iowa State University, 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program. It's been a while since we've spoken with Nancy Pearl, librarian extraordinaire. We thought we would at least start our conversation with her on books that would be great for parents to read with their children as they are growing up. Nancy Pearl, former director of the Seattle Public Library and author of the Book Lust series, joining us hour two of our show. This hour, all things political, Professor James McCormick, Professor Chair, Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Jim in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, how are you?
All right, how are you?
Great.
Good.
I want to talk today about voting rights and homework assignments for progressives to jot down. The first thing is that I think we have to change the frame. Sirica said that this was voting rights was becoming an entitlement, and it seems to me that in the context of treatment of the poor in the Bible, that the, we ought to frame it in terms of voting rights are God-given rights for the poor and for everybody else. Secondly, in terms of the Supreme Court vote, we have to activate ourselves not only in terms of nationwide, but also in terms of the state Supreme Court, and get progressive churches, minority churches, unions, and students mobilized to turn out a heavy vote for the Wisconsin State Supreme Court election. Third, we need to write to Justice Kennedy and ask him to do the right thing and point out that this was renewed by the Senate, for example, 98-0. Fourth, we need to actually pray that there'll be some sort of change among the five conservatives in the Supreme Court so that we can have an opportunity to appoint a progressive justice in the future. And finally, it seems to me that we have to hold the Republicans' feet to the fire on this this issue, and also their previous action in the 2012 election, and to point out that all of the Republican, I can't think of one Republican leader that said anything about the dirty tricks on voting rights in the 2012 election, nor have I seen any Republican leader come out at this point in time and say that the voting right, that the Supreme Court should renew the Voting Rights Act. And so we should confront them for their hypocrisy in this affair.
Professor McCormick.
Well, that's quite an agenda.
It is.
was set out here. You know, that's kind of interesting. One of the things I just pick out here about writing the Supreme Court justices, certainly we can petition our government. You know, sometimes we think of the Supreme Court as insulated from, you know, sort of the clamor of the public debate, and that's obviously not true. And they certainly are aware of what goes on. I think the Voting Rights Act was renewed in 2006 for a 25-year period, and caller's right, it was unanimously passed in the Senate and by an overwhelming margin in 300 plus in the House. So obviously there's a fair bit of support. I think the crucial issue, and we didn't get into it, is that this Section 5 preclearance applies to those, and really part of the debate is applies to those states that by 1964 or previous to 1964 had less than 50% of their voting age population going to the polls. And so that's how these particular states were identified, and even some even within some states. So I think the crux of the issue is, and maybe that sort of define a little more carefully, is has that situation kind of changed? And that's what Shelby County is arguing here, that you know, certainly over the last 40, 50 years, I mean, this situation has changed. So that might be one other thing that the caller might want to incorporate into his discussion.
What about a change in the Supreme Court? Do you see anything in the near horizon that would indicate that this president has a chance to nominate somebody else?
Well, I mean, you know, there's been some justices that have had some health problems. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is obviously the one that comes to mind with a couple bouts of cancer, as I recall. You know, but that's sort of on the liberal side of the court, if you will. I don't think that there's on the conservative and I'm not sure about the state of Justice Kennedy's health, but you know, he's often seen as a swing justice. But the others, and I don't think there's any indication, for example, that Anthony Scalia, sort of the leader of the conservative wing in many ways, is about to end his tenure.
Let's spend just a couple minutes before we go back to phone calls. There was a big story on Governor Walker, Scott Walker, in yesterday's paper, and whether or not he's really pursuing a presidential run here. I'm just interested in your thoughts as we were talking about conservative members of the court, conservative members of the Republican Party. Where do you think it is right now, and what are the, this is kind of
my question would be, is how many times has he been in Iowa?
I don't know how many times. You would know that better than I would.
with the Iowa caucuses, I mean, well, I'm being a little bit self-promoting here for the Iowa caucuses. I mean, that's sort of always that's the starting point, and of course, that's where candidate Obama got his start here. I would be surprised if he's not a candidate. I mean, obviously, he has to win re-election, it seems to me.
Yes.
And he has to win re-election, I think, pretty profoundly, you know, to support, to kind of put himself in a position to pursue a national position. So I would look to that first, and I suspect his sort of his mantra, and I haven't followed this in the Wisconsin papers, but I suspect his mantra is that he's focused only on completing his term as governor and so on and so forth, and he'll look to the future. But I would be very surprised if he were not after 2014, if in fact he is reelected, if he would not be a candidate, because it seems to me the field is pretty open in terms of defining where the Republican Party is headed, and I think that he would want to be part of that debate.
And when you look at how the Republican Party is defining where they're being, where they're heading, what kind of definition do you come up with? We heard so much from the last election; they really have to increase Latino vote. They've got to persuade more people to vote for the Republican Party. Who are they persuading right now?
Well, I think, you know, and maybe this is a segue into talking about immigration, but. You know, obviously, Marco Rubio and his efforts to champion a bill with a coalition of other senators, the seven other senators, is this effort to get a handle on the Hispanic vote is one way that the Republican Party is trying to move, and I think that's why in some senses Rubio has kind of escalated himself right up the ladder here in terms of his presidential prospects here. I think the other one, of course, is, although I personally think he's probably sort of too kind of electric for some folks, is Chris Christie. If he wins, as he, you know, he's got a 74% approval rating or something in New Jersey at the moment. If he wins big in New Jersey, a state that Republicans have not carried in a presidential election in some time, he obviously places himself in a good mold. So I think there's a number of candidates, and he would be more, I suppose, the economic kind of conservative, Rubio in terms of kind of the Hispanic attractiveness. I would be surprised if in some fashion that Rubio is not on the 2016 ticket.
Jim, thanks for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi. First of all, the Justice Department and the Voting Rights Act. The Justice Department, under Obama and Holder, do not believe in treating people equally. J. Christian Adams, who used to work in the Justice Department, became a whistleblower, wrote a book called Injustice, shows how its anti-white racism dominates that Justice Department. This goes beginning in 2009 with the dismissal of the suit against the New Black Panther Party, the most racist party you can imagine, some of whose members advocate extermination of the white race. And by the way, Obama stood on the platform with members of that party. The notion of equal rights is not being followed by the Justice Department, and therefore there's no real need for this this Voting Rights Act as it was originally set up. Furthermore, you see the hypocrisy of the liberals and the progressives with the notion of having women in combat. At the same time, Representative Glenn Moore of Wisconsin's bill for women. Victim Act or something, you know, something like that, Victims of Violence Act. Why not have a victims of violence rather than women victims of violence? And if women are so weak and so forth that they have special actions, then why do they do? What are they doing in combat? The hypocrisy of the progressives. We've got to defeat them. We have to have a good Wisconsin Supreme Court by reelecting the woman. Rogensack, happily, you know, there are so many issues. We have a wonderful sheriff, a Democrat.
All right, let's start with the two you brought up. You want to respond to Hugh, Professor McCormick?
Well, I think there is that Philadelphia case that he mentions early on in the Obama administration. Frankly, was troubling, it seems to me, why they didn't go through and you know, engage in some litigation on that matter. I think that has been seen particularly by critics as, you know, as perhaps not being as fully even-handed. One other thing that he suggested I'd like to bring out about this and what came up in the debate in the Supreme Court was, you know, sort of as a federalism issue in terms of, you know, this, the voting, you know, is predominantly a state prerogative under the Constitution. And so, you know, this was one of the arguments that was brought up by one of the justices. Actually, it was brought up by Justice Kennedy, that, you know, is there a sort of a federalism issue here in terms of with the Section 5 here and the Voting Rights Act? So it may well turn on that, you know, sort of dividing powers between the state and the national government.
You think the Justice Department is racist against whites?
Oh, I don't. I mean, I think that you know is obviously overstated here, you know. But I do think that on I will say again on the Philadelphia case, I think that they should have done more.
Let's go to an email. Tyler emailed to say, now with a sequester in effect, what happens if nothing happens? What if everyone takes the cuts in stride, and the sky doesn't fall?
Well, I suspect that will be more likely the case than not, because, in fact, what these agencies will do is will make adjustments. It'll be interesting to see. You know, the predictions are that there are going to be 700,000 jobs lost. It will be interesting to see. I mean, we always have problems in counting how many jobs are created and how many jobs are lost. You probably know that in Wisconsin as well, you know, because politicians make these kind of statements about how many jobs they're going to create. We certainly have it in Iowa in terms of governor campaign here. So it'll be interesting if we really can scrutinize how many jobs are really lost. I think there are going to be furloughs, mm-hmm. for example. You know, that's not the same. It's not that they don't hurt, but that's not the same as losing a position. So I'll be interested to see, you know, if some of those projections, if you will, actually bear fruit.
But when you say furloughs, of course, do hurt, and there will be people who will not have as much money in their paycheck, not
That's
be
right.
able to participate as fully in the economy because they have been furloughed. Those could be significant developments, couldn't they?
They will slow down the, you know, the sort of the recovery to the extent that we have this kind of recovery going on here. So, in that sense, it is problematic, and that's why presumably, again, I'll say, you know, that maybe will that be the impetus for getting this kind of larger bargain? My own sense is, if a deal was struck that suggested the parties working together, that actually would have a real stimulative effect on the economy, in the sense that it would free up a lot of money sitting on the sidelines currently, you know, in terms of the kind of automatic reaction. I think that's more likely to be the case than any kind of these piecemeal efforts that are being done presently.
Jerry in Menasha, hi.
Oh, good morning. Yes, I've for many, many years since FDR, we know the GOP has been trying to get rid of what they have framed as entitlements, what I call social contract. As far as Social Security goes, there's such a simple solution, and I can't believe that it has not been taken up. I've talked to my legislators about this. Simply lift the lead of $106,000 up to $200,000 or $2,500. Whatever, and it'll be all set for decade after decade after decade, because Social Security did not cause this deficit. It has nothing to do with it. Yes, there's a lot of room in Medicare that has to be scrutinized, because there's a lot of fraud there. There's a lot of lack of oversight. That particular program should be investigated. As far as the voting rights issue goes, I think that true, with the states being picked out as those who have in the past supported suppressed voting rights. I think that issue should be set aside, but I think something should be put in place nationwide, because there hasn't been a state that has not been approached or put through in their legislative body voter ID, cutting back on the time to be able to register, not allowing certain groups like the League of Women Voters to register people. There has been a nationwide voter suppression. And
all right, Jerry, thank you for your call. Professor McCormick.
Well, I think she makes a very good point about Social Security. I mean, what she was referring to is the cap that is on Social Security taxes, you know, 6.2% that is up to, it does go up a little bit each year, but it's $106,000 now, and that means anybody making, you know, over $106,000 doesn't pay any additional Social Security taxes. They do pay additional Medicare Medicare taxes here. And I think that's a very good area that could be increased and get a fair bit of revenue, and that would be wholly consistent, at least in my view, with the ability to pay in terms of Social Security. So that is really one workable way. And I think she's right about the social contract. I'm certainly not in favor of people that have already paid into the system and that are already collecting to in any way lose any of their benefits. But I think for the long term, too, the other area is that there's got to be some means testing of Social Security and the benefits that people get if they have lots of other resources, and that would not be for those in place, but probably, you know, for, I talked about under 55, and that sounds like you know, people that could still adjust their retirement package. Makes a very good point, I think, too, about voter IDs. I mean, you know, that's one of the areas that would be covered by the Section 5 for these particular states, but it does not apply nationwide. But if you look at the cases that have been held, I mean, and I haven't looked at all of them, but I did take a brief look at some of the previous cases on voter ID, the courts have been pretty protective of making certain that voter ID laws, you know, do not go overboard here. We have I don't know about the state of Wisconsin, but the state of Iowa here, we have a controversy over the voter ID at the present time.
Yeah, we do too. It's been challenged in the courts. It's kind of on hold. What about nationally, though? Will Congress take up this issue, or will this be another Supreme Court issue, the whole voter ID, early voting, et cetera?
I'm afraid that Congress has enough on its plate right at the moment. I mean, unless there's a number of cases of egregious and demonstrable violations, that would be the only sense that I would see it being taken up. Most of the efforts have been done and at either the district court or the appeals court levels so far, and frankly, most voter rights, you know, sort of putting restrictions on these voter ID, the court has tilted in that direction rather than in terms of endorsing these voter ID restrictions.
Thanks, Jerry, for your call. Marie in Bayview. Hi.
Hi, I have a mouthful, too. Number one, it sounds crazy to say this, that we should just get rid of the sequester, but I think it's the only way we can get to the real problem of what's going on, and that is health care in our country costs way too much money, and we're not getting what we should be getting for it. And when we're paying twice as much as any other country for our health care, that just seems wrong. So what I think we need to do is take a very, very serious look at health care and how we provide it. I know everybody thinks we did, but I guess I don't think we did.
Professor McCormick.
Well, what I'm anxious to see is exactly, you know, there's already been some, you know, evidence of rates going up and services being restricted, even with the new health care law. I'm really waiting as it gets into full force by 2014 And I think at that juncture, maybe before, but you know, probably we'll have to wait until after the 2014 elections to see what the sort of the disposition of the Congress is. I think that the caller has a good point to take this up, because we'll start to see more fully the ramifications of the Affordable Care Act and see what it really does in terms of healthcare costs and healthcare delivery.
I thought the statistics were the opposite, that the costs haven't gone down significantly, but there has been a decrease in healthcare costs.
Well, that's not been the case in Iowa. I'm just, you know, we have some insurers that have really started to ramp up the costs, and I think the explanation is largely that I believe the explanation is that more people are being covered.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Marie, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. It's All Things Political for this Monday, the 4th of March, and our guest is Professor James McCormick, professor and chair, Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. Our phone number, a couple lines are open right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program this Monday, Nancy Pearl will be joining us, and we thought we would at least start our conversation with best books for parents to read with their children as they are growing up. But Nancy has a phenomenal memory for books, and she has read more books than anybody I know. So if you need recommendations for your book club, or if you would like to give us a recommendation, they're always terrific hours with Nancy. She'll join us hour two of our show. Back to phone calls now. Let's go to Marty in Palmyra. Hi, Marty.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In regards to the up-and-coming Supreme Court, Wisconsin Supreme Court election, I want to thank your commentator for stating the obvious by stating that Justice Scalia represents a conservative faction. So much for a court comprised of impartiality. I want to give a shout-out to Ed Falone for calling a spade by stating his political bent. Anybody who thinks that these courts are impartial, you need your head examined. And money talks. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Are you concerned about courts at the state level, Supreme Courts, or U.S. Supreme Court becoming too political, Professor McCormick, or not?
Well, we've had a recall election in Iowa, in 2010, which a couple justices were.
Yes, I remember.
Yeah. And we had another one this past election, and that judge was that justice was not recalled. I guess I'm of two minds in this. I think that the courts have to be held accountable. Obviously we want some independence for these justices, but I think it was Justice Holmes, but you can correct me if I'm wrong. Says that the courts do read the public opinion polls or something like that, and so they're not divorced from the public arena here, it is one of our institutions those are political institutions, so I guess I'm not overly troubled by that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Dave. Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I know there was some discussion about Scott Walker's national chances of running for president, and I think that, someone that runs to the right of Mitt Romney is not going to have much of a chance. Plus, his track record in Wisconsin, the state of Wisconsin, I think, is not in very good shape. We actually had more people leave the state last year, and we're doing pretty poorly in terms of job creation and just the general vibe that he's created in Wisconsin, I think, has been very negative, and what he's done to the schools is only just starting to take effect, demoralizing the teachers and sort of his divide and conquer mentality. I just don't think he could stand up to the national press's scrutiny of his college career and what happened with his the people that he supervised as a county executive, and I think his negatives are on a national level, other than his appeal to the right wing of the Republican Party, I think his chances are very slim.
All right, Willem, thanks very much for your call. I don't know if that needs a response, but we thank Willem for the call. Bud in Trempealeau. Hi, Bud.
Hey, how are we doing today?
Well, okay, Bud. How are you?
Not too bad. Good. Not too bad. The snow hasn't come in yet, so.
Wait till tonight, huh?
Yeah. Anyway. Here's the thing I was wondering. I'm on Social Security now, and all these years we've been told, okay, invest in IRAs to keep money for when you retire. In the last 10 years now, interest rates have been nothing. So we haven't gotten any from that. The seniors have been getting beat up with that, and now you want to cut Social Security and that. Why can't this be Social Security or something be tied to interest rates?
Well, I don't think that there is any disposition for cutting Social Security for those that are current recipients at all. That's sort of a mantra that's sometimes out there, but I think it's really looking down the road at those people that are sort of the next generation that would do in the retirement. I mean, I'm of the baby boomer group here, so I'm sensitive to this sort of thing. So I think that is where the focal point is. Tying it to interest rates, there is a cost of living provision, as I understand it, that the government gives in terms of Social Security adjustment. I think that that's probably better given what you've talked about. I don't know if it's been the past 10 years, but certainly for the last several years, the interest rates on any kind of investments have been, at least fixed investments have been arguably flat here. So I think it's probably better in terms of sort of the cost of living here to tie it to that.
And thanks very much for your call. Let's spend just a few moments, if we can, talking about our new Secretary of State, John Kerry. What a difficult job that is. Every time, it's amazing how much press the Secretary of State gets. It's almost every newscast, all day long. The Secretary of State was here or there. Do you see any kind of special imprint that he has made? How's he doing so far?
Well, he's on a 9-nation tour here, sort of just getting his feet wet. What I thought you were saying about you see him in the news all the time. What sort of depresses me immediately about the job is the inordinate amount of traveling. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, when she was in that role, I guess set some sort of record here in terms of miles covered here. And I suspect that Senator Kerry, who was actually a little bit older than Secretary Clinton was when she was in the job, has even got more of a challenge here. I mean, he's obviously met some roadblocks or stumbling blocks already. I mean, he had a sort of a bumpy meeting in Turkey here, one of his stops here. And then, of course, just yesterday in Egypt, mm-hmm. It's not been probably as smooth as he would like. I mean, he had to beat back a comment by the Prime Minister of Turkey over a comment about Zionism and so on. I'm sure that put a little bit of ice in the meeting that he had with the Turkish Prime Minister, and then of course meeting yesterday with the President of Egypt. And even though he ended up giving him $250 million in aid, or at least releasing $250 million, he also had to share a fairly a stern warning to him. I think it was interesting where he visited and where he didn't visit. I mean, he did meet with the Soviet foreign minister, I guess, in Paris, but he didn't really stop in Moscow. It was really sort of a Middle East trip rather than Asian trip. And what surprised me a little bit about that is, the Obama administration in January 2012 talked about how we're going to pivot to Asia and how that was very important. But most of this trip has been sort of Middle East and Europe here. So it's been more traditional, maybe reassuring traditional allies. So that was one thing that struck me. It was maybe a second trip will be to Asia, but I was wondering about, whether, he's going to have that sort of Asian priority.
Let's go to Barb next in Ricetown. Hi, Barb.
Good morning. I would like your opinion on something. What I'm proposing should be related to government spending cuts. But what would you think would happen if all foreign aid was reduced by 20%? Across the board, no favorites, let's bring that money back home, or I should say, keep it at home.
It's a drop in the bucket, though, isn't it, when you look at the budget, Professor McCormick?
Yeah, I mean, depending on how you calculate the total amount of aid, maybe we provide $25 million, and there's always an issue of what's included in that number. And so, if you make a cut in that, you don't 25. Did I say million? I meant billion, of course. 26 billion is the current foreign aid budget. You cut 20% out of that. You're not. You know, you have some real money. It'd be real money to you and me, but I don't think it makes much of a dent in things. That it maybe has a good heroic symbolic impact for some folks, but I think those $5 billion that you might get, probably could be used more effectively in terms of development and long term sort of prevention of some of the crises that we might face worldwide.
Thanks very much for the call. When are we going to see votes on a ban on assault weapons, on universal background checks? When does that issue move forward?
Well, that's a very, very good question. I mean, certainly hearings have been held, testimony has been taken. What is front and center, of course, now is still dealing with the budget kind of question here. To my knowledge, a timetable has not been set forth of when those votes would be held. I think they're probably still counting noses here to see what kind of votes numbers they have.
Mm-hmm. So there was talk after Newtown that this vote should happen pretty soon, or the chances of significant legislation were.
Well,
not
they talked
very
about the end of March, into April, and that was when they would. Maybe we'll see if they get through this week or over the next couple of weeks, get this budget deal, that really clears and unclogs a good part of the agenda, whether it's immigration or efforts at gun measures as well.
Well, that's a good word to use, isn't it, Professor McCormick? That things seem to be rather clogged, don't they?
They do. and some would even be harsher than that. I mean, it's really been stalemate here. In terms of the legislative process, and frankly, I would say the legislative executive process here, because these are wedded together, whether we like it or not. I mean, there's sometimes a focus on the Congress, but two have to get together here to really dance here and to get any kind of an outcome. And it's really been clogged all the way around. I mean, I think there has to be more. I mean, I applaud the president for making these calls on Saturday to try to form up a coalition of the willing, if we can use sort of the military jargon here, to unclog the legislative process. I think this should have been done weeks and months earlier here. I mean, that's the way. There's a classic book in political science by Richard Neustadt, that the real power of the president is the power to persuade. And that means, knocking heads together here and, kind of in the Lyndon Johnson mold. Let's go and have a drink together and talk about this.
Right. Let's go to Dave in Cobb. Hi, Dave.
Yes. I think your professor had hit to what I was going to ask. Like old days when Reagan and Tip O'Neill were in office, and maybe it's come past the point we should just have a jury room and lock them in and sequester until they come up with the decision.
Well, Camp David, rather than the jury room, is sometimes suggested. It would be good for them to go up there. Congress always doesn't work. It's got that Tuesday-Thursday schedule. So they have a long weekend that they could get up there and get away and get something done.
You really think so?
I'm being a little bit facetious here, but there is an opportunity to make them earn their money as well.
Right. Professor McCormick, we thank you very much for being with us. It was a lively hour. A lot of areas. Thank you.
Thank you.
Even though we're clogged, there's still a lot to discuss. Thanks to Professor James McCormick. He's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University. For those of you who may just be tuning in to Wisconsin Public Radio, we do these All Things Political. It's the only show we do regularly, but every Monday at 9, We have all things political, and it's always a good hour. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks for all of your calls. Next hour of the show, please stay with us. We're going to talk about books, and particularly books that you read with your children growing up. Nancy Pearl will be joining us a little later this week, just to keep your mind on things Washington, a book on Calvin Coolidge. We love doing presidential books, and this book has been receiving really great reviews. So Calvin Coolidge, I believe it's on Wednesday. I'll correct that. If it is Wednesday, yes, Wednesday, Calvin Coolidge will return.